From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the passing of Aretha Franklin. We talk with soprano Mary Lynch, who was Aretha's opera coach for 20 years.
It was like it was meant to be. I felt, honestly, very natural with her. She liked me and liked my voice, and that's how it started. I would sing part of the aria, and then she would sing it back to me. She learned everything by ear.
A NASA probe to touch the sun.
So the purpose of Parker Solar Probe is to design a spacecraft that can actually plunge into our sun's atmosphere.
And a roadmap to bring broadband to everyone in Michigan.
Broadband impacts nearly every facet of life, from economic opportunity to applying for jobs to access to healthcare information, which is growing phenomenally right now.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the world lost Aretha Franklin.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free.
You make me feel like a natural woman.
Woman.
What you want, baby, I got it. What you need, do you know I got it? All I'm asking is for a little respect when you pass a little bit.
Aretha Franklin died this morning at her home in Detroit from pancreatic cancer. She was 76. Her musical legacy is unparalleled, including that night in February 1998 when she stepped on stage at the Grammys. With less than 45 minutes notice and no rehearsal, Aretha Franklin sang Puccini's famous aria, Nessun Dorma, stunning most people, but not Detroit-based soprano Mary Callahan Lynch. She was Aretha's opera coach. It was a remarkable 20-year partnership. And would you believe, 3 weeks ago, Aretha Franklin called wanting to learn a new aria. We'll talk with Mary Callahan Lynch later in the program. But first, Michigan is lagging in broadband availability, 30th in the nation. More than 350,000 households, mainly rural, do not have access to that vital high-speed internet service. And in 2018, people who don't have effective high-speed internet may not have access to news or social and job connections, schoolwork, healthcare, and much more. This week, Governor Snyder released the Michigan Broadband Roadmap. The goal, provide access to high-speed internet to every Michigan resident, business, region, and community. Here with us is Eric Frederick, Executive Director of Connect Michigan, a nonprofit working to expand broadband through the state. So good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So this roadmap announced by the governor shares the very same goals as Connect Michigan. And as it turns out, you have been a big part of writing this roadmap.
Absolutely. So broadband is very close to Connect Michigan's mission. We are working to expand broadband infrastructure, but also the adoption and use of technology to help improve quality of life and community and economic development. It's absolutely critical to survive in a digital economy these days. We have so many great places to live and work across the state, and they absolutely need infrastructure and to be able to afford it and use that technology to improve their quality of life and grow.
Before we talk about the roadmap, help us to just better understand what it means to be one of those Michigan households without broadband. I mean, what are some of the day-to-day consequences for people?
That's right. So broadband impacts nearly every facet of life, from economic opportunity to applying for jobs, to access to healthcare information, which is growing phenomenally right now, access to educational opportunities. And for households that are not connected to broadband, all those opportunities are very, very limited. Having school children who bring devices home from school, because many schools are doing one-to-one device programs now, they come home and those devices turn into a brick because they can't connect to the internet to complete their homework or to read books or however they need to interact with their school. We have families that are driving those kids to libraries to get connected or to the Wi-Fi signal at a McDonald's or another location. So it can be very difficult for families who need the connectivity for school and things like that, but also the other benefits of it. We look at telehealth and telemedicine and the opportunities that it brings to allow older folks to age in place instead of having to drive or be closer to a healthcare facility.
Or
to
be
treat.
Driven to.
Exactly.
Yes.
To have to move and move away from their homes to be closer to healthcare facilities. They can use telehealth and telemedicine, but they can't if they're not connected. So there's a big impact that broadband or lack of broadband there has on homes and businesses and institutions across the state.
Why is Michigan so far down in the state rankings for broadband availability? Number 30 is not anything to be proud of. How did that happen?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how spread out we are. Mm-hmm. Across the United States, the average population per square mile in the United States is about 85 people, relatively low compared to many other developed countries around the globe. Michigan's average population density is about 23. So we're a spread out population. We do have, you know, most of our population is centered in southern Michigan. If you were to draw a line across the state, crossing through Clare, most of the population is located south of there. So when we look at broadband expansion and we look at the households that don't have access, it's a relatively small number compared to the number of households we have in the state. However, it has a big geographic impact. So you start seeing large swaths of area just outside of small towns, just outside of suburban and more urban areas that because the population density drops, it's much harder to expand broadband there for a private entity, for a public entity, any entity where the number of customers drops. And capital costs increase to put more infrastructure in the ground. That low household density is really the biggest driver to a lack of broadband in rural areas.
But there have to be other states in the union that have large rural areas that have done a better job of getting broadband to their residents than Michigan did. What could we learn from them?
We can take a look at how the state and other public entities have really gotten behind this mission. We found that in our work with Connect Michigan, we work with a lot of communities across the state, and we found that where we get best results at a local level is through public-private partnerships. So it's not just the private sector responsible for expanding infrastructure, and it's not just the public sector. It's about both of those entities coming together and really understanding each other to expand.
And we've heard the same story when it comes to the roads.
Exactly. Yep. And so when we see the public sector starting to put some skin in the game, if you will, and really investing and making broadband a priority, we see that the private sector starts to work together with them. And then we see expansion into the rural areas where a purely private sector model doesn't necessarily work.
All right. I have the Michigan Broadband Roadmap here released this week. It is a very weighty report, very in-depth report. Since you've helped to write it, let me have you break it down. What recommendations do you think are the most valuable and the most achievable and realistic?
The report is chock full of quite a few recommendations, and they're varied. They're very different. The report really wants to make sure that we're addressing not just infrastructure. Infrastructure is absolutely critical for broadband and enjoying all the benefits that it brings, but we also need to be addressing adoption. Broadband adoption is, you know, a home, a business, an institution being able to subscribe to service and then being able to use it. And so the report has many varied recommendations because we're addressing not just infrastructure, stuff in the ground, but actually the affordability, the digital literacy, the talent related to broadband. So we're trying to make sure that it's comprehensive in nature and not just stopping at infrastructure. So there's a number of things that I think will be really key to improving broadband in the state and moving forward. And first is that public-private partnership model. Mm-hmm. And the report makes recommendations in helping to solidify and make model partnership agreements so that we can help communities and private sector providers navigate those waters more efficiently. So I think that's one that will really help a lot of communities across the state get better connected. Making sure that we're connecting our anchor institutions, our schools, our libraries, our healthcare institutions, our government office, public safety, all of those things that make up our communities in Michigan, we need to make sure that they have connectivity. And so there's a big push to make sure that those institutions are connected. And thereby, there's lots of residual impact by connecting those institutions. We then better connect communities at a broader scale. So I think those two things are some of the biggest points that will help better connect Michigan and get those connections out into the rural areas of the state.
So this was a big priority for Governor Snyder. He kind of, you know, unveil that this week. He's not going to be around after the beginning of next year. Let's talk about the political hurdles that might be faced in making this something that is a workable tool that makes a difference in people's lives as opposed to a report that winds up on a shelf.
Right. And that's something that we really took to task when we started laying out this report, is that we wanted to be a guide for future administrations. Knowing that Governor Snyder wasn't going to be have another term in office, we really wanted to make it something that any elected official could pick up and run with. Broadband is a pretty apolitical topic. It doesn't really sway one way or the other. It's something that absolutely everybody needs. The challenge is, how do we get there? So I think by making sure that the report was a guide for future administrations, regardless of party, I think it really helps set the state up for great success in terms of broadband.
So what are the elements of making this happen and closing this broadband gap?
Right. So a lot of states and a lot of entities, when they think about broadband, they stop at infrastructure. It's simply the pipes in the ground and the signals in the air. However, at Connect Michigan, we really look at the access, adoption, and use of broadband. So access is the infrastructure, making sure, again, those pipes are in the ground and the signals are in the air to get connected to the internet. But we also make sure we're looking at adoption. So we also try to address issues of affordability, of digital literacy, of technology awareness, so folks know why they should have an internet connection, what they can do with it. Those elements can often be forgotten. The build it and they will come model with broadband doesn't work. Just because infrastructure is in the ground doesn't mean folks are going to subscribe to it or even be able to if they wanted to. So that's why we need to address not just infrastructure issues, but the affordability, digital literacy, and awareness of that as well. And on the use side of things, which is the end of that spectrum, we want to make sure that community anchor institutions and governments are using technology to improve quality of life, whether it's offering telemedicine and telehealth applications or expanding educational opportunities or offering government services online in a more convenient, cost-saving type of way. There's ways that technology can be used to improve community and economic development. So that's why we look at it in that spectrum.
And that spectrum is represented in the Michigan Broadband Roadmap.
It is, absolutely.
Eric Frederick, Executive Director of Connect Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
My name is Patricia Merriweather, and I went to Aretha Franklin's father's church when I was probably about 14 and heard her sing. Oh, she was beautiful.
My name is Veronica Dunbar. I still have my CD set of all her best, and I play it in my car quite often.
Bruce Patterson. It's just kind of a sad day. It's the end of an era, really. I mean, she's the queen of soul.
You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. We'll be back after the break.
Quintessential Detroiter.
She really represents Detroit, and few people do that so well.
I think Respect has the best piano and bass line of any song ever written.
I mean, even though she was a world traveler, she always came back to her roots.
And she's going to be truly missed.
You are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we remember the life of Aretha Franklin throughout today's program, we'll have much more later in the hour. Right now, we change gears as we turn to Michigan festivals. It's been enjoyable exploring the unique summer festivals that happened around our state, celebrating everything from baby food to bologna. This coming Saturday, you can head towards Muskegon for the first ever Great Lakes Surf Festival, which bills itself as a celebration of Great Lakes surf culture. Joe Bitawid has been riding the Great Lakes for some 30 years. The festival is his idea. He's with us now. Joe, what gave you the idea to pull all this together into a festival?
A couple of years ago, discussing it with a few friends, we thought that it would be great to have an event that would bring everyone together, different board riding disciplines, and just really to have a celebration of Great Lakes surf culture.
So the idea is it's not a competition. It's not just a festival. It's, as you say, a celebration. And what kinds of board activities are we talking about, Joe?
Well, Cindy, we have over 40 activities going on Saturday, August 18th at Pier Marquette Beach. And we focus on entry-level lessons, so we will be teaching hundreds of people how to surf, paddleboard, and kayak. And we'll also have family-friendly events. So we've really focused on trying to make this an all-around event so that board heads can come and enjoy it, but also beachgoers that just want to have a great beach day can also come and participate and enjoy the event.
And when we talk about board heads and we talk about the kinds of fun that people can have on the water, so we're talking, as you mentioned, paddleboard, there's kiteboarding. I have a very good friend who lives to kiteboard, the surfer board that we know of from Beach Boys tune. So we've got all kinds of activities, right?
That's correct. I mean, we really have a full day, and I think it'll be an amazing event because it'll be a scene out of, you know, somewhere you would see in Hawaii or California. You know, we have a great, great surf culture on the Great Lakes, and we're on the cusp of having the second generation of riders. You know, I consider myself a first generation Great Lakes waterman, and now we have the second generation. And so we also, part of the reason for this event is we wanted to empower that second generation to kind of showcase that history that we have. And so we're excited.
Tell me about riding the Great Lakes. How does it compare to, let's say, what we might have seen in Hawaii or off the coast of California?
Well, Cindy, when you think of surfing in Hawaii or California, your mind immediately goes to the image of a sun-kissed culture. On the Great Lakes, it's a little different. It's more elemental. There are times where we deal with harsh conditions. And the activity, I would say that it would be more victory at sea than, you know, the sun-kissed scene. But with that said, during the summer months, it's a very viable activity for someone who's getting into surfing, paddleboarding, or kayaking. And one of the amazing things we have now is we have some really great retail presence. So we have up and down the coast, we have great retailers that offer lessons and just make it really, really easy and conducive for people to get into these sports and learn the correct way and the safe way.
And people can enjoy these sports on the inland lakes as well.
Sure. I mean, that's amazing. We have so much water and so much access.
And I know you are a former professional windsurfer. You've been riding the Great Lakes for, some 30 years. Take us into the feeling, a perfect day on the water for you. How does that feel?
Well, the other nice thing about riding on the Great Lakes is oftentimes it's not crowded. And so the perfect day is sunny on a sandy beach and surrounded by friends. In my case, my wife and my kids love the beach and enjoy the beach. So that would make it a perfect day.
Well, for veterans or newbies, there it is all happening this Saturday, the first Great Lakes Surf Festival at Pier Marquette Beach near Muskegon. And you can get all the details at the website, greatlakessurffestival.com. Joe Bitawid, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing your love of being on the water.
Cindy, we're so stoked to be on your show, and we hope that you and anyone listening would come and join us. It'll be a great time.
It is the stuff of science fiction. Send a space mission to the sun. But science fiction became reality this week as NASA launched the Parker Solar Probe, humanity's first ever mission into the part of the sun's atmosphere known as the corona. In the words of NASA, to touch the sun. Justin Casper is a principal investigator for this historic mission and a climate space science professor at the University of Michigan. I asked him, just what is it about the sun they're hoping to learn?
Well, one of the most perplexing things about the sun that a lot of people might not know is the surface of the sun glows yellow because it's at around 6,000 degrees Celsius, which is pretty hot.
Yeah.
But if you go just a few hundred kilometers above the surface of the sun, the temperature actually rises. And the solar corona sits at around 1 to 2 million degrees. It's nearly 1,000 times hotter than the surface. And we'd really like to understand what physics is happening there that's able to heat an atmosphere to make it so much hotter than the surface.
Because it doesn't click with what we understand with our atmosphere.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, just think about like a campfire. You put your hand near the flame, it's hot. You move your hand away, things cool off. That's just fundamental thermodynamics. It's what we're used to. The further away you are from heat, the cooler things get. So something is able to take some form of energy, get it up into the atmosphere, and then dissipate it and heat it to these really high temperatures.
And I know that the solar probe is going to be helping us understand the solar wind.
Yes.
What is that?
That's right. In the 1950s, a professor, Eugene Parker, who the mission has now been named after, realized that it's actually totally unstable for a star to have a million-degree atmosphere. Given the mass of our sun, it can't actually hold that atmosphere in place. So the corona actually wants to lift off away from the sun. And then what happens is it actually feels a accelerating push as it expands outwards. So by the time it's a couple solar radii away from the sun, it's moving at faster than the speed of sound. And by the time it's maybe 10 solar radii away, it's moving at maybe a million miles an hour. Or hundreds of kilometers per second.
And when you say solar radii, what kind of distance are
we talking
about?
Yeah, let me put that in perspective.
Yeah.
So an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the sun. The Earth is about 215 solar radii away from the sun. I'm talking about things that are happening in the first 5 or 10% of the way from the sun to Earth.
Okay. So as that's happening and moving out, how does that affect us here on Earth?
Sure. So turns out once this wind is created, it's moving in jets in every direction away from the sun at extremely high speed. So what it does is it carves actually a bubble out of the local space in our galaxy. So our entire solar system and all the planets orbiting the sun are being bathed in this solar wind. And the solar wind is incredibly variable. There'll be very high-speed gusts that might be moving at a few million miles an hour, and then it slows down to just half a million miles an hour. And so imagine your Earth, you have a protective magnetic field that's shielding you from a lot of the radiation in space, but you're getting buffeted by these different streams. This is fundamentally what causes a lot of the aurora and northern lights, but can also disrupt GPS navigation, mm-hmm. radar, radio communication. We call all this phenomena, we now call it space weather. It's like weather in space. And it can have a huge effect on society.
And what might we learn about that through this probe?
There are two things. I'll just give you two examples of things we do really poorly. We do a really bad job telling whether or not one of these gusts of solar wind is going to hit Earth, if it'll be fast or slow. And then every now and then we have a very violent eruption on the solar surface called a coronal mass ejection. And that's when a big chunk of the corona actually gets hurled out at very high speeds. So we call those CMEs or coronal mass ejections. And just to try to put that in perspective, a coronal mass ejection might involve an amount of mass equivalent to all the water in Lake Michigan going from rest to moving at a few million miles an hour in just a few minutes. And so if one of those CMEs hits Earth, it can cause a huge disturbance. There was a very famous event more than 150 years ago we call the Carrington event. When it swept past Earth, it set telegraph lines on fire. The northern lights were seen all the way down to the Caribbean, and compasses just started wiggling around wildly. We worry that if an event like that were to happen today, it could potentially knock out all power distribution on the east and west coasts of the United States. We would potentially be without electricity for years. It's very hard to even calculate what impact that has on society.
So it's a very good thing to understand
this a bit better. It's a good thing to understand it. Exactly.
Tell us about this trip to the sun, this probe. How many miles and how long will it take for the probe to get there?
Yeah, so it turns out one of the reasons it took so long to do Solar Probe is it's actually really difficult to get close to the sun. And this might seem counterintuitive, but Earth is actually moving around the sun at a pretty good clip. So we have two problems with our spacecraft. First, we need to escape Earth's gravity. But once we get up into space, we actually have to slow down compared to Earth in order to fall towards the sun. So there were earlier ideas like we'll go out to Jupiter and we'll swing around Jupiter and it'll fling us towards the sun. We wound up coming up with a way that lets us get to the sun a lot closer. So we launched this week. We're currently now scrambling, checking out all the systems on the spacecraft, and it's headed straight towards Venus. And in just about 7 weeks or so, we're going to pass just a couple hundred kilometers over the surface of Venus. And we're going to cheat a little bit. We're going to speed Venus up just an imperceptible amount. And Venus, with its gravity, is going to slow us down and bend the spacecraft's orbit towards the sun. So just this November 1st, we'll have our first encounter with the sun. I said Earth is 215 solar radii away from the sun. We're going to get to 35 solar radii, about 1/7 of the distance back towards Earth. That'll already be closer than any human object has ever gotten. Over the course of the next 7 years, we have 5 more encounters with Venus, each time letting us get closer and closer. So by the end of the mission, we're less than 10 solar radii, or about 4% of the distance above the sun. And those will be our closest approaches.
So this idea that we're going to touch the sun is almost as good as.
Yeah, well, so what does that actually mean as a scientist? There's a special type of wave in the solar atmosphere called an Alfvén wave. It's a magnetic wave, and they move really fast, so even faster than a sound wave. We think, we don't know exactly where this is, but we think 10, 20 solar radii above the sun's atmosphere, the wind is now moving faster than even these Alfvén waves. And that's where we think you make the transition between a solar atmosphere that's rotating with the sun and it's in communication with the sun and this kind of detached solar wind. So if we can get below that so-called Alfvén point, we can actually see the solar atmosphere for the first time. So that's what we mean when we say touching the sun. We want to get in there and scoop up samples of the solar atmosphere.
Now, I know you're a principal investigator for the instruments on the probe, observing the ions and electrons.
Yes, that's right.
Taking the samples to make up the solar wind and atmosphere. And I understand you think of one of these instruments, the Solar Probe Cup, as the bravest little instrument.
Yes, that's right. Well, so the beautiful thing about this spacecraft for most of the instruments is we have this amazing state-of-the-art heat shield. It's about 10 square meters. It's made of a foam of carbon. I mean, if you looked at it, it kind of looks like shaving cream foam or something like that. It's almost translucent up close. But it's made of carbon, and it can withstand temperatures of like 3,000 degrees. The front of that's at 1,500 degrees Celsius, but the back, which is only like tens of centimeters thick, the back is only at a couple hundred degrees. And so instead of seeing this intense sun that would vaporize almost any normal material, all the instruments in the shadow, they'll see amount of heat equivalent to the light bulb in a refrigerator. So barely any heat at all. So they've got a wonderful journey ahead of them. They'll get really nice, strong signals, but they'll be in an environment that's very similar to if you were on a spacecraft orbiting Earth. But the Solar Probe Cup, unfortunately, if we want to see the solar wind, which generally flows away from the sun, we need an instrument that looks straight at the sun. And we can't have a heat shield just covering the whole front because the wind has to flow into the instrument. So what we have to do with the cup is actually use refractory metals and artificial crystals that we grow, very special materials that can withstand these extreme temperatures and let us actually see the wind and collect samples of the wind in the atmosphere and read out things like how fast is it flowing, which way is it headed, you know, is it flapping around or not, or is it steady? Basic observations like that.
You're kind of blowing my mind as you describe all of these things. And I know you're a scientist, but do you find yourself thinking that this is the stuff of mythology?
I know. You know, you sometimes, well, first of all, you sometimes sit there going, you know, okay, we're going to touch the sun. Like, doesn't mythology suggest we shouldn't be going there? Hasn't this gone poorly for other people in the past?
Didn't go well for Icarus.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's definitely an historic, well, I don't want to say accomplishment yet. We've launched, and so far things are going well, knock on wood. But I think it will be a very historic moment to send a spacecraft to a star for the first time.
What does this mean for mankind?
Well, at a minimum, I hope that it's going to significantly improve our understanding of our star and other stars. So, you know, understand what's responsible for these really high temperatures in our solar atmosphere. And then in terms of knowledge for mankind and benefits, I think of it in two directions. One, space and the solar atmosphere, it's like our little nearby laboratory where we get to see hands-on what plasmas are like in the rest of the universe. So, you know, material falling into black holes, the material spinning around a young star as new planets are being formed for the first time. These are all plasmas that are very difficult to recreate in the lab. So if we can go there and understand, you know, how the magnetic field is involved in heating, how different structures form, that's going to inform our understanding of a lot of other astrophysical objects. And then if you look on Earth, you know, I mean, I'll just pick one example, and who knows if this will work out, but, you know, controlled fusion is potentially like the way in the future for the ultimate clean energy source. And what we struggle with is how do you get the plasma in a fusion reactor really hot, and how do you confine it? There are these instabilities that rip it apart. We don't understand how to heat it very reliably. My hope is one day we'll take what we learn with probe, and maybe we can apply that to things like fusion power.
What happens to the probe at the end of the 7 years?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So there are a lot of things we're really worried about. We're going to unexplored territory. So, of course, we always worry there's something, you know, that we're unaware of, right? But there are a couple things that we know are going to be a problem. I mentioned before that the sun is about 500 times brighter. That means the light is so intense that at closest approach, the pressure from the photons from the sun itself is so intense, it would flip the spacecraft around in under a minute if we weren't actually actively pushing back. So we have these big wheels in the center of the spacecraft. And as we get close to the sun and the light pushes on us, we spin the wheels faster and faster to push back. Now, you might imagine there's a motor in there. The wheels can only spin so fast. So every now and then we turn on, the spacecraft actually decides on itself when to do this. It turns on a rocket, fires the rocket, and while the rocket's on, it slows the wheel back down to zero. Now, we think we have a lot of fuel on the spacecraft, but at some point, and I hope it's much longer than the 7-year primary mission, at some point we're going to run out of fuel. We won't be able to spin down that wheel, and the sunlight's going to flip us around, and the sides of the spacecraft could only survive for seconds before they'd be vaporized. So then, for the next billion years, the heat shield and our solar probe cup and a couple other high-temperature instruments will basically just be in this weird elliptical orbit around the sun until, bad news is about a billion years from now, the sun is going to expand and swallow up a solar probe in the Earth. But until then, we'll have this nice little relic of our mission.
And you and I will not be around to worry about
that. That's right. Not our problem.
Justin Kasper, a principal investigator for the Parker Solar Probe and a climate space science professor at the University of Michigan. Fascinating, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We will talk more about the Queen of Souls' life after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For the rest of the hour, we will remember the life of Detroit's very own Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul. To begin, WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter has this recap of her life.
Aretha Franklin's impact on music is almost impossible to measure. Born in Tennessee in 1942, her talent as a mostly self-taught pianist and powerful singer was apparent from a very early age. She toured as a child in a traveling gospel revival show featuring her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin. They relocated to Detroit, which Aretha Franklin always called home, and her earliest recordings were made at her father's church. But in a 1999 interview on the public radio show Fresh Air, Franklin remembered traveling through the Deep South to sing with her father, and discovering just how deep racism ran in America during the 1960s.
It certainly was not what I was used to or accustomed to in Detroit. There were times that we were asked to go to the back of the restaurant, say, or we couldn't use the bathrooms.
By then, Franklin had segued into pop music and R&B. She'd also developed a reputation for being a bit difficult to work with. Broadcaster and current WDET music host Jay Butler booked her for a show when both were in Tennessee, beginning a relationship that lasted the rest of the Queen of Soul's life. Butler says Franklin was extremely gifted and extremely demanding.
She was an exceptionally talented person, so her personality kind of reflected somewhat of a diva attitude, because they're very meticulous about their work.
Franklin began producing a chain of hits, including the song Respect, which reached number one on the charts in 1967 and earned Franklin her first two Grammy Awards. Her success continued into the 1970s, though it began to fade as disco music came to dominate the charts, and Franklin herself struggled with some personal issues. A cameo in the 1980 Blues Brothers movie introduced her to a new generation of fans, and she again became pop music gold, producing hits like Freeway of Love. The accolades poured in. Franklin became the first female singer inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and earned 18 Grammy Awards. Aretha Franklin was 76 years old. I'm Quinn Kleinfelter.
As we showed you at the beginning of today's program, Aretha Franklin's voice, interest, and her talent extended to opera. Her coach for the past 20 years was Detroit area soprano Mary Callahan Lynch, who's the founder and director of the Motor City Lyric Opera. Mary, in 1998, you get word the Queen of Soul wants an opera teacher. You, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I was stunned because not only was it Aretha, but she wanted to learn a tenor aria. And then I found out it was because Luciana Pavarotti had requested that of her, and there was going to be a bash at the Waldorf in New York, and so she wanted to learn it. And I was, of course, beyond honored and thrilled, went off and learned the Nessun Dorma, which was, of course, Pavarotti's signature aria, and that's how our relationship began.
I want to get back to that first lesson. So there you go. You are going to coach the Queen of Soul. How did you choose to approach the lesson and your first meeting?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because at the time, you know how when you are just so busy, I was just immersed in so many things that if the timing had been different, perhaps I would have been, oh my God, I would have been nervous. But honestly, I was just excited and to go for it. And it was formal at first. You know, I was told to call her Miss Franklin, and she called me Miss Callahan Lynch. And then after about an hour, it was just a very natural, it was like it was meant to be. I felt, honestly, very natural with her. And she liked me and liked my voice, and that's how it started.
So what kind of student was Aretha Franklin? How did she approach the lessons with you?
Well, obviously, she's a musical genius. We all know that. I would sing part of the aria, and then she would sing it back to me. She learned everything by ear. She had an extraordinary ear. And in preparation, I made a tape of me singing the aria, because, of course, as a soprano, as a female singer, it was better than listening to a male voice. And then I sent her a tape of the pronunciation of Nessun Dorma, you know, the Italian, and the translation. And she was just so eager and was like a sponge. And, of course, being so incredibly musical, it was not difficult, really. She just, boom. She was fierce in her eagerness to learn it. And, of course, loved it and loved Puccini and fell in love with opera. with this experience of learning this aria.
It's just stunning, I think, to most people to think that she made that transition from belting Respect to singing this legendary Puccini aria.
Yes, and what I think, you know, some purists may say, well, you know, she didn't have the technique of an opera singer, but the truth is she brought her take, her massive soul to this aria, and of course made it her own, as she did everything. Any music, you could tell within the first couple of measures who was singing, if it was Aretha. And so she brought her distinctive voice to it in more ways than one. And what I think is so amazing is she brought opera to people that maybe would never even heard an aria. But because of her wide audience, you know, it was exciting for me to see that happen.
Well, then comes this moment, the 1998 Grammy Awards. And she gets this last-minute call to cover for an ailing Luciano Pavarotti and sing his signature aria.
Yeah, his aria with a 45-minute notice, obviously, with no rehearsal. And if you watch it or hear it, she nails it. She just nails it.
Let's take a listen.
Nessun dorma. Nella tua fredda stanza. Guardi.
Mary Callahan Lynch, how did you feel watching your student?
Well, I was just blown away, and I was so proud of her, and it was just a thrill. It was truly a thrill.
What did she do right?
I think, well, the thing about Aretha is because she was so her own, not improvisational, but almost, you know, when she would work with the conductor, because I would travel with her, they would say, so how do I conduct her? I said, oh, no, you don't conduct her. You just keep going with the orchestra. You conduct, and she does her thing. And really, Cynthia, what was so extraordinary is how she did that. I don't know of anyone else who could sing a Puccini aria and get back to perhaps what was originally meant, you know, the beat. She would move through it almost like a jazz singer, but did it right. I really, it was a phenomenon.
And as you watch, I'm goosebumps all over as you watch that clip of her singing at the Grammys, and she puts her stamp on her performance. Let's listen to her switch from Italian to English.
Within my heart, my secret lies, and what his name is, none shall know, none, till on high eyes I confess it. Soon as morning light shall dawn.
It's actually hard to talk to you because I'm sitting here wiping tears away at that voice. What did Aretha Franklin say to you the first time the two of you spoke after that triumphant performance at the Grammys?
I just said, brava diva. I was like, whoa, you nailed that. And, you know, she had cords of steel, but she had nerves of steel. I mean, I just don't know of anyone else who could really have done that.
What did she say to you?
You know, I think we were just so excited that it happened. Really what she said is she called because she was getting so many requests from all over the country from different orchestras that wanted her to sing. And what we really focused on is, okay, what aria do we want to learn now? And she loved Puccini, so I taught her the Vici d'Arte, Which is a gorgeous aria from Tosca, the Omio Babbino Caro from Gianni Schicchi, Ombra Mai Fu, Handel's aria. So we really, you know, just focused on that. She was like, okay, now what?
And then in 2001, you founded the Motor City Lyric Opera, and you wanted to bring opera to young people all over the city, and she got involved. What did that mean to that mission of yours to spread appreciation of opera among kids in Detroit and Southeast Michigan?
Well, I had been working with her for just a few years at that point, maybe three years. And I have to admit, I was reticent to approach her. I mean, she was the queen of soul, and we hadn't traveled that much together yet. And I called her and I said, Aretha, I really want you to think about something. And when I told her about the company and that we were starting a board of directors, and would she consider being, an honorary board member? And I was very candid. I said, Aretha, your endorsement would mean so much for what we want to accomplish in the city of Detroit. And, she said, Mary, I'm asked for from so many people. Can you imagine that would want her to be on her board? And she said, let me think about it. And she called me the next day, and she said, Mary, I would be happy to, because I really do believe in what you're doing. I love opera. She loves children. And she really loved the city of Detroit. So the timing was quite like an anointed moment, because it was an endorsement, I guess that's the word that comes to mind. And then the thing about Aretha that people don't know, that she was very generous and behind the scenes. So there were a couple of times when, with a nonprofit, and I went to her and I said, Aretha, we really need help. And she gave us help. But it was not to be, really publicized. She didn't want any kudos or... It was quite touching, and she really loved our Opera on Wheels program, and she loved the anti-bullying. And just 3 weeks ago, we were talking. That's why this is just staggering what's happening. We were going to have a coaching, and she was very eager to learn this German aria, Marietta's Lied. And we were talking and figuring out our schedule when we could meet for the coaching, and she asked how the company was going, and I said, oh, we're expanding our outreach. We're doing a Detroit Song Collective, and we're going to expand our Opera on Wheels to high school students. And she was so excited and actually was willing to support it in every way. And anyhow, that was the last time we spoke.
But you actually heard 3 weeks ago, she said, I want to learn a new aria. What does that say to us about her?
Well, I mean, it's extraordinary. I think her tenacity, her will to learn, her love of the music. In fact, she had called me, I think about a year ago, and she said she hummed this tune. Dee-da, dee-da-da. But she didn't know what it was. She goes, Mary, what is it from? I said, oh, that's Marietta's Lied. And she was, I love that. I really want to learn this. And I said, well, it's in German. And German is no joke. it's Italian. It's beautiful. It's easy, the open vowels. And so I did a recording. I sang it for her. I made the tape of the German. And this was about a year ago, and she still was ending her very active performing schedule. And then, she canceled. And then just 3 weeks ago, she was all excited about meeting. And I had no idea that she was so ill. Now, a year ago, we presented an award to her at the Detroit, Music Festival. That was last June.
Her final Detroit performance.
Yes. And, I could sense she had lost weight, and you could tell she was walking up the steps and needed help backstage. And boy, she went out and just let it rip. I mean, she just was such the consummate performer and loved it. I had asked her once, I said, Aretha, don't you get tired of being on the road? And she said, no, Mary, I've been doing this since I was 14, and I love it. She truly loved every part of it.
What do you believe Aretha Franklin brought to this world?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, they call her the Queen of Soul. And I think Aretha was so deeply spiritual. And, you know, when you do hear her sing, it does give you shivers. And I think because she had such a close relationship with Jesus and was very proud of it, of course, she had that indoctrination with her father and with gospel music. But I think she so unabashedly honored the gift God gave her. And I think it just was blazing, you know. I feel like she was a fire with it and was so true to the gift she was given. And so I think that's an amazing gift. She brought her own voice in every sense of the word.
Mary Callahan Lynch, Motor City Lyric Opera founder and Aretha Franklin's opera coach for how many years, Mary?
20 years. We met in 1998.
That is a remarkable relationship. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Okay. Thank you, Cynthia.
One of my favorite songs by her is You're All I Need to Get By. It's just a good old soul funk song.
I've followed her since the very earliest days when she was singing gospel at her dad's church.
They really had a gospel thing going in their church. And it was really nice because we didn't stay far from her father's church over on Linwood. And it was really an experience I never will forget.
And you've been hearing memories of Aretha Franklin from Glenna Washburn, Bruce Patterson, Veronica Dunbar, and Patricia Merriweather. And that is Stateside for today. A special thanks to Sarah Swick for gathering the memories of Aretha Franklin from Detroit.
Love you together, together, together.